Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Toobin, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Toobin.
Good to talk to you, Ian.
And just a few days ago in the vice presidential debate, the issue of the Supreme Court came up, and I guess Paul Ryan gave Joe Biden an opening by explaining his position on abortion, which then Biden was able to tie into a Supreme Court under a President Romney, where the choices of justices would be made by Robert Bork. Do you think that woke a few liberals up in this country?
Well, I don't think there are a lot of liberals out there who are contemplating voting for Mitt Romney, but I think one of the paradoxes of American political campaigns for president is that people don't pay as much attention to the Supreme Court as they should have, as they should, because it is such an important part of a president's legacy. It's a question I often ask political professionals on both sides. Why don't you talk about the Supreme Court more? And apparently the answer is, whether it's true or not, I can't say for sure, is that swing voters, the people who decide the outcome of elections, generally don't care much about the Supreme Court, and they are not motivated by the issue. But, you know, facts are facts, and Supreme Court appointments are an important part of any president's legacies, and it should be something people think about when they vote in November.
Well, obviously, when the Democrats run out of good arguments and fail to motivate their base, they usually bring up the Supreme Court. But there's no question in the polling that Romney's ahead in likely voters, and that's the key, isn't it? So that's why I think that the White House is trying to motivate the Democrats to vote.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, everybody's trying to motivate everyone to vote, and I don't see, I think any liberals who are contemplating not voting in this election, you know, have to be delusional or not paying attention or somehow, you know, just not engaged with the process. You know, I think this is an election really being fought over swing voters at this point, and you know, I don't think a lot of them care, but maybe I'm wrong about the Supreme Court.
Well, there's one person that appears to care deeply about the Supreme Court, and the fact that she's still not on the Supreme Court is something of a tragedy, because Sandra Day O'Connor apparently went to Rehnquist and said, you know, I know you want to retire and I want to retire to take care of my husband, but if you're going to stay on, then I'll retire. Or if you don't want to retire, I'll retire. And then what happened was that Rehnquist said he'll stay on, and then she retired and then found her husband barely recognized her. And then Rehnquist subsequently died. I noticed that she showed up at the Supreme Court the other day on the affirmative action argument, which would, if the conservative majority overturn it, it would be overturning her ruling. So what do you understand about Sandra Day O'Connor's regrets here? Because it seems to me that she was such a unique and valuable member of that court, having had legislative experience, I think the only justice to have had legislative experience.
In quite some time. Oh, well, look, Sandra Day O'Connor was an epic figure in American history, and her departure was really a tremendous loss for the court. And for so many at so many levels, but I think, you know, her departure illustrates a great theme in American political history, which is the disappearance of moderate Republicans. They are simply not in Congress anymore, and they're not on the Supreme Court anymore. And I think you need only look at the last three departures from the Supreme Court, Justice O'Connor, Justice Souter, and Justice Stevens, to see how moderate Republicans became alienated from their party. Stevens and Souter so alienated that they gave their precious seats on the court to a Democrat. And if you look at O'Connor's subsequent career, she has embraced Democratic causes a great deal more than Republican causes, that's for sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, the staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. In your book, Jeffrey Toobin, you say that when Sandra Day O'Connor, in her last days on the court, told David Souter, quoting her, "What makes this harder is that it's my party that's destroying the country." And she spoke about George W. Bush, the president. "He's destroying the military with adventures that we aren't prepared for. We've got colossal deficit spending, and the only way he can get elected was by getting states to vote on same-sex marriage." That's pretty tough talk.
Very tough talk. You really put your finger on a very striking moment in The Oath, I think, that captures the degree of alienation that Justice O'Connor felt and feels from the modern Republican Party. But look, that's a big part of contemporary politics. I mean, this alienation, and you see it. You see it in Congress, and you see it in the court, and it's real.
So what happened to that tradition, if indeed it was a tradition, Jeffrey Toobin, that you would replace a justice with somebody that was similar? And in the case of losing a African-American justice, the Bush senior White House replaced him with Clarence Thomas. Obviously, he was nowhere near the political outlook of his predecessor. But in the case of a leader replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, my understanding is that he is one of her least favorite people. Is that true?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's personal, but I think it is that these seats are too precious for presidents to worry too much about. They want to put their stamp on the court. And yes, they care about gender and racial balance, but they mostly care about getting their point of view victorious. And that's why ideology matters far more than any sort of ethnicity or gender. Now, Democrats perhaps have the luxury of, you know, there are so many competent men, women, lawyers that President Obama could appoint Sonia Sotomayor, who was, you know, who is of course the court's first Hispanic, but also someone who is, you know, overwhelmingly qualified to be on the court. Same thing with Elena Kagan, you know, who represents the first time there are three women on the court. Again, not a big, he got to appoint a woman, and he also got to appoint someone who reflected his point of view.
Your description of Thomas as being somewhat bitter about the fact that both Obama and Biden voted against him, that to me, and this also applies to Justice Thomas, who I recall was profiled once on 60 Minutes when he had a book out. And he was so bitter and vengeful about the liberals that went after him in what he described as a high-tech lynching in his confirmation. And I'm just wondering, isn't that the antithesis of a judicial temperament, that judges who hold grudges?
Well, you know, Justice Thomas is a paradoxical figure because at one level, he is among the very most popular of the justices on the Supreme Court among his colleagues. He is someone who gets along very well with them, and he is not someone who has had any, but at the same time, you know, as you point out, he is deeply bitter about how he was treated. And I think his silence during oral arguments, which has now gone on 6.5 years, is part of his saying, essentially, screw you to the people who've mocked him. It's just, it's a bizarre way to behave, but it's just how Thomas has done it, even though, you know, he remains an influential justice with his colleagues. It's a strange situation, which I can't explain completely.
Well, when you mentioned earlier that the Ledbetter Act that was overturned by Obama and the Congress, obviously, and that was, I think that was suggested in many ways in a stinging dissent by Souter, wasn't it, that the Congress would have to step in. And the fact that Alito was unhappy about it. The other question, though, that arises here is, Alito appears to be a fairly faithful corporatist. And I remember at the time of his hearings that I spoke with Cass Sunstein, who's in the White House, and I believe he vets a lot of people. And I was asking him about, don't you have reservations? And he was actually quite okay with Alito. And I'm surprised that the liberals in this country aren't more attuned to whether or not these justices are corporatists. These are not the questions that come up. Abortion and other questions seem to dominate these hearings, but not their philosophy and on corporate power. And nothing is more evident than a gift to corporate power than the Citizens United decision.
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with Cass Sunstein's view on this particular issue. I'll take your word for it, but it certainly reflects that Republicans are much more motivated and much more tough on judicial appointments than Democrats have been. I mean, the Republicans have obstructed Obama's nominees to the court at a level that the Democrats never did with Bush's appointees, and Democrats essentially gave Roberts and Alito passes. I mean, there is nothing surprising at all about Samuel Alito's record as a justice on the Supreme Court, given his history. And this is just a difference between the two.
So, Jeffrey Toobin, in your book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, you mentioned how that at the end of the 2007 term that Stephen Breyer was distraught at the court's turn to the right. He also, I believe, questioned Roberts' integrity in terms of this controversial ruling, Citizens United, which has clearly had a profound effect on this election, this six...
I don't know about questioned his integrity. He certainly questioned the result in the case. This is a huge issue. I mean, this is a major issue of... it shows how aggressive conservatives have been. You know, one of the themes of the oath is that Obama is the believer in stability, and Roberts is the one who wants to change things. And that's what you see in the decisions like Citizens United, and especially Citizens United.
Well, there was a recent interview by Justice Scalia, by Nina Totenberg, about the effect of Citizens United, which one would think is pretty manifest to the evidence of what it's done and what it's doing. And he said, Justice Scalia said, I don't know what people are complaining about. It's a perfectly reasonable law, and there's complete transparency, so people know who's giving the money. There was no follow-up, and I'm astounded. Is he in an alternative universe? Has he not noticed these 501c4s? And
The 501c4s do not have to disclose their contributors, so that there's no disclosure there.
Mm. But what explains Scalia's belief that there is transparency in the ruling?
Well, one part of the McCain-Feingold law that the court did uphold in Citizens United was the requirement that contributors to super PACs have to be disclosed. So they did approve disclosure by a vote of 8-1. Justice Thomas thought that disclosure was unconstitutional, but I can't speak for Justice Scalia. He said what he said. There was some disclosure upheld, but that is not the that's hardly the full story.
So what then is likely to happen with Citizens United? There was some expectation on the part of some court observers that the Montana case would allow the Supreme Court, in particular Justice Kennedy, an opportunity to revisit and perhaps revise the ruling. But he didn't take a bite at the apple, which...
I think anyone who thinks this court is going to change Citizens United is living in a dream world. They are locked in. This Supreme Court, these nine justices, are not going to revise Citizens United. Now, this is why future appointments matter so much, is that the court could overturn or at least limit Citizens United. But it certainly seems to me that the current court has no such inclination.
Well, apropos the earlier question about what motivates Scalia, you might ask what motivates Alito. He mouthed not true when the president in the State of the Union criticized the ruling.
Right. Well, I think that tells you where Alito is coming from. I mean, he is a dedicated adversary of the president. I mean, that is just a major difference between the two of them, and we're seeing that play out day after day.
Well, but the president ultimately, I don't know that he was wrong when he suggested that we don't know how much money's pouring in and whether foreign money can pour in.
Well, that actually, you know, I talk about that in the oath. Both of them have a legitimate argument. The foreign money question was not directly addressed by Citizens United, but it is, you know, the larger effect of Citizens United, I think, can hardly be disputed.
So your book, Jeffrey Toobin, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, you're suggesting that there could be a change in the court in terms of the conservative majority being rolled back a little. But as we speak now, with Romney apparently doing well in the polls as a result of one debate, which is pretty extraordinary in itself, would you revise and extend your remarks, as they say in the Congress, in the sense that which is more likely at this point, getting rid of the swing vote and having it swing back towards a more liberal court, or the idea that one more justice appointed by Romney, would there be no need for the Kennedy swing vote? You'd have a solid conservative majority almost in perpetuity.
This is why presidential elections matter. I sometimes feel like a voice in the wilderness, but about that. But it is true that the court remains a central event, a central legacy of any president. And if people like Citizens United, they should vote for Mitt Romney. If they like Roe v. Wade, they should vote for President Obama. I'm not telling people how to vote, but I am telling them that it matters a great deal who they vote for.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jeffrey Toobin, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst at CNN, and the best-selling author of The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life. His latest book just out is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.